Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Merle Exit. Yeah, I'm in New York City. Looks like a cloudy day, as we say in Yiddish, Manishtana, meaning that's short for, like, why is this night different from all other nights, or meaning, yeah, you know. It's cloudy, it's muggy. Let me look out there. No one's getting mugged, though. Thank goodness. And let's see, today's show. Well, we're going back to Philly. Yep. Well, the show is here, but we're going to be talking about Philadelphia again. What was once a small museum got uprooted and found a much larger home with five floors. It's the National Museum of American Jewish History. And Ivy Barsky, the museum's director, will tell us what to expect there. I personally found it like an overwhelming museum because there's so much to see. And then we're going to go to the Lowe's Philadelphia Hotel, a skyscraper, the middle of the area known as Center City. And Elise Strewing will talk about this historic hotel versus hysteric hotel. I'm also... yes, Esther, hi, how you doing? How about Esther and Eunice are here. What did you, wait, oh. Eunice just said that also Marilyn and Minerva are also hanging around too, but I don't know, maybe they're sure they'll help me out in case I anything that I forget. But in the meantime, you know, it's I hate to do this at 9:30 in the morning, but okay.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
Ah, yes, and you can get these wonderfully delicious, delectable brownies at www.brownies.com. And if you're on the West Coast of the United States, there are stores that you can buy them in. Unfortunately, I'm not. So, it's okay. I'll just send away for them. Okay, so, I think we're... Come on, click it. Yeah, okay. So I believe, do I have Ivy on the line?
Yes, I'm here. My mouth is watering listening to those about those brownies.
They're unbelievable. Oh, and by the way, and they're kosher, too. Just want to throw that out, just in case.
Isn't that great? Sounds delicious.
So, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Oh, just fine.
Good.
I have to say, well, I was, well, I don't remember when I wrote the article, but, you know, it was, you know, at a time when there was that little small museum.
Right.
And
right.
So when I went back to Philly recently, I saw this on a list of you know, where I have the VIP pass, and I went, I'm not going to go there. I was there already. And then I'm looking at it and said, it was built in 2010. I'm going, what are they talking about? This place is old.
Right. So just so your listeners know, right, you're talking about the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia.
Right.
On the corner of 5th and Market Streets, right on Independence Mall.
But before
so
it
you were
was,
surprised, and I hope you came in.
Oh, of course. But because
right.
I said, oh, this has to be a new building, so let me go.
Right.
And so I walk in, and I'm going, oh, my God, this is huge.
Yes, it is.
So,
it's 100,000 square feet.
Wow, that's absolutely, totally amazing. So what I'd like it to do is first give us like a brief thing about the building itself, and then I would like to kind of touch on what's on each, basically what's on each of the five floors.
Okay. So, well, first let me tell you about the building itself, which must be very frustrating to a radio listener because you can't see the real beauty of it. But let me say that it, our website, nmajh.org, as in National Museum of American Jewish History.org, you can see some images of what I'm talking about. The building, as I said, it's a pretty grand architectural masterpiece on Independence Mall. 100,000 square feet facing the Liberty Bell, adjacent to Independence Hall, and really in the most historic square mile of American history. So just the sighting of it, the location of it, is a pretty powerful statement, I think, that this is where we're telling the history of 350 years of American Jewish history, you know, and we're in conversation with those kind of monuments and iconic symbols of America around us. So it's pretty heady stuff. And the building itself is gorgeous, as you know, designed by James Polshek and Ennead Architects. And it has a lot of the kind of terracotta color to mimic and to kind of fit in with the historic buildings near us. But then it has a beautiful glass shell that kind of faces Independence Mall. And I think Polshek was thinking with that glass tower, both so that we could have kind of the conversation with our geographic location and keeping that transparent, the transparency of democracy. And, you know, he kind of uses that language in the museum, which he also built in the museum in Washington, D.C., called the Newseum. So that the kind of transparency of democracy, but also of the fragility of that relationship. And so as you go through the museum, I think the architecture reminds you of that tension, of that our visibility, our freedom, the freedoms of democracy, but also just how tentative and fragile those are and how we have to respect them and nurture them always. So the architecture does a great deal to communicate what the museum's story is, I think.
Hmm.
So I'll tell you about the contents. The whole, because of our siting, and the museum opened in November 2010, but because of the physical geographic space that we occupy, we thought it was very important to kind of center the story of American Jewish history around the concept of freedom. So the floors are really there are three floors of core exhibition, or three and a half floors of core exhibition. You start on the fourth floor, which tells the story of Jews in America from 1654 to 1880. And that's called the Foundations of Freedom. So And I think I speak for most visitors when I say this is the most surprising part of the exhibition to them, because this is the part of the history that's the least known. So it's full of epiphanies and aha moments, because just frankly, most of us don't know this history very well. So it starts in 1654, which and the reason that date was chosen, and that date is traditionally chosen as the date,
which is a question I was going to ask.
Oh, okay. That's when, you know, we establish really Jewish community, and most Jewish American historians establish the beginning of Jewish community in North America with that 1654 date. That's when the first 23 Jews came from Recife, Brazil, kind of fleeing the Portuguese takeover of Brazil. And they knew that that hadn't worked out very well in the 15th century for them, so they better get the heck out of there. And many of the Jews left Brazil. Lots of them went to the islands and to other places. 23 souls, big, little, and small, as one of our documents says, came to New Amsterdam. So, and that is... that's really when but of course they were met by a couple of Jews when they arrived. So why 1654? Why these 23 Jews? Because they were the first community. They came with children. They weren't just going to do business and commerce. They were here to stay and set up communal life here as Jews. So that's how 1654 was chosen by us, and frankly by most people who study this material. And so we deal with all the original settlements of Jews in New Amsterdam, in Newport, in Charleston, in Philadelphia, the first places where they kind of land and make businesses and families and congregations and communal life here in America. And then the story goes on from there. Jews' involvement in the Revolutionary War, which we can get back to because we have an interesting special exhibition related to that as well. We talk about the movement westward of Americans and of Jews. We talk about, I think one of the strongest parts of that floor is on the period during the Civil War, which is, again, a period that most Americans and certainly most Jewish Americans don't really know, the really interesting history of Jews in that period. And that goes up to the 1880s, which is really the establishment of the Reform movement and of the conservative movement in Judaism, and the kind of success and establishment that Jews are able to achieve by that point in kind of the Gilded Age. All along knowing that freedoms are challenged, there are incidents of anti-Semitism. It's not all a pretty story, but it's pretty much a great progression of Jews being able to take advantage of and enjoy the freedoms provided to all citizens, even though there are those things we continue to have to argue for. The third floor is called Dreams of Freedom. That's probably the narrative that many of our visitors are at least vaguely familiar with. It's the period from 1880 to the end of the Second World War. And, of course, the beginning of that floor, 1880 to 1924, is when the great majority of our Jewish ancestors came to this country from Germany, from Eastern Europe, until 1924 when the immigration laws are changed. So for lots of our visitors, that has resonance to their own early history and talks about we have great interactives that describe the process at Ellis Island, for example, and other things about what new immigrants would take with them, what communal organizations, educational organizations they established when they got here, their struggle to assimilate and acculturate, and also to hold on to their traditions. And, of course, that floor also takes us through lots of the exciting cultural things that happen in Jewish life in this period of time. We have a great theater that deals with the movie moguls and Hollywood and Jewish humor. And And then it takes us into the period of the Holocaust, but we are not a Holocaust museum. There's very little real estate actually devoted to this, but interestingly, it's from the perspective of American Jews. So it's not about necessarily what was happening in Europe, but it was what American Jews knew about what was happening in Europe, what the American Jewish community did and didn't do in response to that, and what the American government did and didn't do in response to what they knew. And also about the Jewish participation in World War II as, of course, as Americans in enlisted and volunteering for military service. Then the second floor takes us to the post-war period. So this is the period from 1945 to today that most of our visitors, of course, know very well. And the beginning of the floor deals with both what happens to the surviving remnant from Europe when they come to the United States, the aftermath of the war here in the United States for them, and also the migration to the suburbs for Jews, often on account of the GI Bill, but often just a move from kind of having made it in or becoming a little more successful in those urban centers and being able to move out to suburbia, and what that means for the growth of synagogues and leisure time and all those sorts of things. We have a fabulous section there that's one of the most exciting parts of the exhibition, I think, for a lot of visitors, which is a small exhibition on summer camp. So there people get to weigh in on their camp experiences. We have you can upload your images from your own camp, and we talk about then Jews in the civil rights movement, in the women's movement, and other, and in the movement for Soviet Jewry, which is of course coming upon its 25th anniversary now. And I'll just finish this what seems like a very long summary to tell you that then that floor ends with two interactive experiences for visitors to kind of weigh in and become part of our story. One is called Contemporary Issues Forum, and that poses four questions, which we change periodically. And you know, one question, for example, right now is America too free? Another question is social media a good thing? I'm paraphrasing. But visitors then get to answer yes, no, or and write their short comments that get scanned. These can also be seen on the website, but they're also seen on site. And so you weigh in and become part of our story, which, and of course, Jewish life today, American life today is changing every minute. So the technology allows us to change those questions and adapt to things that are happening in the present, which is, you know, great. And then we have these booths called It's Your Story. They're the It's Your Story booths, and you can go in similarly, and most people do this with family groups or with friends, although many people do it on their own. And again, answer questions in kind of a two-minute format. What's your favorite holiday? How is your life different than your ancestors? What does freedom mean to you? And so that's a place where we collect content from visitors to the museum. That's really, you know, a very powerful opportunity that many of our visitors take advantage of. So that's the heart of our core exhibition. But then we have a beautiful space, which you might remember, in the lobby that's called Only in America. Do you remember that space?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so that is a place, you know, while the entire museum, these three floors, 25,000 square feet or so, talk about these 350 years of Jewish history, mostly from the point of view of regular folk. But we did decide that we needed to celebrate those people who have made incredible, extraordinary contributions to American life. So we have 18 featured in short films, two-minute films, and artifacts. And in those include Albert Einstein, Jonas Salk, Rabbi Schneerson, Estee Lauder, you know, really a great swath of Justice Brandeis, a great swath of Jewish Americans who have Barbara Streisand, Steven Spielberg, exactly, who have done extraordinary work.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have interactives along the sides for the many hundreds of other extraordinary Jewish Americans who just didn't make it into the final 18. And that's also a very active list that gets added to all the time. So that's the core. Of course, we also have a fabulous cafe, a world-class museum store that you can access at judaicashop.net, or it can be accessed through our website, nmajh.org, that the New York Times called one of the best curated museum stores around. And we've got a beautiful theater and classrooms where we do educational programs. And then we have a fifth floor that's available for rentals and events, our own and others, bar and bat mitzvahs, weddings, corporate events, fundraisers, and a special exhibition space. And when you're ready, I'll tell you about the special exhibition we have up now.
Well, I just have a couple of questions. First of all,
of course,
when you have, I guess, like inductions then, when you decide, like...
Well, we haven't gotten to that point yet. You know, the museum's been, you mean for the Only in America section?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. The museum's been open 20 months, and we're very happy with this installation in the lobby. But, of course, we will be adding to that in some way. And that's, as I said, an ongoing process, not necessarily for the 18 right away, but for the interactives on the side where we are adding those who have achieved great things.
Okay. I have a couple of questions you may or may not be able to answer. I had noticed, like, when my grandparents came into the States, they came in through Baltimore, and I guess a lot of people came in through Baltimore. Yet, if you go to Baltimore, you don't have something like, you know, an Ellis Island historical thing that lists who came into Baltimore. Do you have anything in there that talks about, like, the...
We certainly have not a comprehensive archive or anything like that, the way, for example, Ellis Island has, but we certainly talk about other points of entry, you know, because not all Jews came through, or not all immigrants came through Ellis Island, of course. And so we talk about all the other, you know, many of the other ports of entry, including Baltimore, Galveston, Texas, you know.
Oh, yeah, Galveston was a biggie. I was reading something about that, that there was actually, and I don't know the name, there was somebody who put up the money to have a whole bunch of Jews go into Galveston, and from there they were going, like, up the Mississippi River to different areas.
So we, you know, we don't act as an archive like that. I will say that there is a great Jewish Museum of Maryland that's in Baltimore, and they might know more about where you can get those. And there's also a website, jewishgen.org. I don't know if you know about this. It's a fabulous website where people can research Jewish genealogy. And they have a lot of documents like ship manifests and port of entry lists of names. So that might be a good place for someone who's interested in researching their own family history to at least start their investigation. That's jewishgen.org.
The other thing that I had noticed, which I thought was quite interesting in researching, you know, my past, to find out that, grandparents were from, two from Russia, one from Austria, and one from Poland. So I just, I'm a Euro-American. That's what I have to call myself. But the interesting thing was the pattern of, in looking at the, the census. And it was noticing that if Jews were coming from Europe, it would never say, like, for instance, it would never, when they said what language, list of languages that they spoke, then we never say, like, Polish or Russian Mm-hmm. It always said Yiddish.
Right.
On the
right,
census.
Well, uh-huh.
Which I thought was...
So,
yeah.
Interesting. It is, yeah. But I don't know if... And, you know, but not all Jewish immigrants spoke Yiddish. I mean,
yeah.
it wasn't that every Jewish family coming from Germany spoke Yiddish. And certainly later, the immigrants coming from, you know, the Middle Eastern countries, the Jews who came from Iraq and Iran and Egypt, they weren't speaking Yiddish. So it's for many, you know, and you know, and I'm sure your grandparents are part of this category. They spoke many languages. You know, Yiddish for many of them might have been the language they spoke at home, but most of them spoke Polish or whatever the other language was in the marketplace, in school, depending on where they went to school and what the timing is. So most of our ancestors were multilingual, you know,
mm-hmm.
and spoke a minimum of two languages or three. So
you're right. Okay, so what I want to get into then is the exhibit on the fifth floor.
Great. Happy you asked. We have a fabulous exhibition that's up through September 30th, so your listeners have to hurry to see it. We have 2 months now. It is called To Bigotry No Sanction, George Washington and Religious Freedom. And it's basically an exhibition centered around a correspondence between George Washington and the Jewish congregation, the Hebrew congregation of Newport, Rhode Island, which we now call the Toro Synagogue, or refer to as the Toro Synagogue. And the short story is basically that George Washington was traveling around so that people could congratulate him on his presidency and also on the ratification of the Constitution. Rhode Island was the last of the colonies of the states to ratify the Constitution. So George Washington went there in the summer of 1790. And, of course, all the different leaders of the community would have read public letters to him congratulating him and singing his praises, and also kind of peppering their letters and their speeches with, you know, their requests for what they wanted from their president. And one of these, and surely one of the most articulate, was this incredible letter penned by Moses Satius, who was kind of the president of the congregation, the Hebrew congregation in Newport, and a leader of his community, and of the Masons in Newport. So he was a big macher by any standard. He wrote this gorgeous letter that then Washington responds to in August 1790 after he leaves Newport. It was written in Philadelphia, the letter. And it quotes from Moses Satius, but also elaborates on the letter that he's responding to. And in it, George Washington writes that happily the government of the United States gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. And he goes on to really declare in the strongest, boldest, most courageous, poetic language that all citizens, the inherent rights of all citizens in this country, is religious liberty. And he says, he quotes from Micah, to apparently his favorite quote from the Hebrew Bible, to say that each citizen should be able to sit under his own vine and fig tree in safety, and there shall be none to make him afraid. Other very strong, beautiful language to assure the congregation and others that religious freedom is a right of every citizen in this country. And so it's an extraordinary piece of writing, an extraordinary document. And it had been in private hands and hasn't been shown for a very long time. We were able to borrow these two letters, both the one from Moses Satius to George Washington and the one that Washington wrote back. And those are the centerpiece of this exhibition, To Bigotry, No Sanction. We surrounded it with other objects important to the history of religious liberty, the early history of religious liberty in this country. So we have an early printing of the Declaration of Independence, the first public printing of the Constitution, other very meaningful correspondence that Washington had with other Jewish communities, but also with Catholics, Lutherans, Quakers, Baptists, assuring them of the very same thing. So, and then some documents where Jefferson takes it, I would venture to say, even further to then make sure everyone understands that this religious liberty, this religious freedom that we guarantee, also includes separation of church and state, sanctified religion of this country, and other important things, and having to do with the religious liberties we enjoy here, unprecedented in the world. So it's a really profound exhibition. We opened it right before July 4th. Visitors have just been stunned and moved by the emotion of seeing these original objects together and having that kind of early history about religious liberty unfold before their eyes in the way the citizens of the country then would have understood it. So it's a great exhibition. We have a very small catalog, small but beautiful catalog that has the documents transcribed in it that we are selling at our museum store, that for those people who can't get here before September 30th. But it's really we're so proud of having been able to both borrow all these important artifacts and documents and to be able to tell this important story to Americans of all stripes.
So in other words, the claim is that the first synagogue is in Newport?
Well, no. The first synagogue is Shaharith Israel Mill Street Synagogue in New York. And there are Torah was not the first synagogue. I think it has the distinction of being, in terms of edifice, it was one of the earliest congregations for sure, but there were several. There was New York, there was Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia, founded in 1740. There are other early synagogues, but the Toro Synagogue is the longest standing building. And so it does have that distinction, but it was one of the early foundational congregations.
Oh, okay. So now, what's the cost of coming to the museum?
Of course, for members, it's free, so it's a fabulous idea to become members. You could do that on the website. But regular admission is $12 for adults, $11 for seniors and students. Children under 12 are free. And entry to the museum includes everything, so the core exhibition and the special exhibition. There's no separate charge. I will say, I would warn visitors, and you probably know this, of course, that they should allow a lot of time, because our core exhibition, we say you can do it in 2 hours, but really it's you're going to want to spend a lot longer, so allow for a bunch of time.
My article comes out tomorrow, and what I wrote about it is, I said, okay, here's what you do: have a good solid breakfast, get there at 10 o'clock when it opens.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
2 hours later, take a break.
Have
go
lunch
into the
in
cafeteria.
Our beautiful cafe. Exactly.
Yeah.
Sit
have
for a little while,
drink,
relax.
A little nudge.
There you
and
go. And wear comfortable shoes. Wear comfortable shoes.
But there are places to sit. I mean, there's places to rest.
Right. And I should say, there are 30 films and 13 interactives throughout the exhibition, and many of them are opportunities not only for fabulous content and engagement, but also, as you say, a place to, let your feet rest for a little bit while being entertained. So that's a good thing, too.
You open every day?
We are open Tuesday through Friday, 10 to 5, and Saturday and Sundays, 10 to 5:30.
Okay, so in other words, even though it's Saturday, you're open anyway.
We are open. We think it's really important. Obviously, people who are observing Shabbat are not necessary. Although, you know, people in walking distance do come, but it's you can buy your ticket in advance, so you don't have to have commerce on Shabbat. But since the spirit of Shabbat is really about learning and family time, we think our place is not a bad way to spend a Shabbat or a Saturday. So we want to make sure we have, you know, we can optimize all the opportunities we have for education and engagement.
That's great. And again, the website is?
www.nmajh.org. So National Museum of American Jewish History.org, nmajh.org.
That's absolutely great. Well, I really appreciate your calling in and telling us about this. I probably couldn't do as well. I didn't spend enough time more glancing than I did,
mm-hmm.
To me, I had gone to the Barnes Foundation,
mm-hmm.
and it's like both places are overwhelming, meaning you can't, it's like...
Yeah.
It's not like you can spend a half an hour, you know.
No, you want to allow
really
time. But you know what? A lot of people do, as you say, a quick first visit. They try to kind of get the scope of the whole thing, get a sense of the big ideas, and then come back and do things in more depth. And you know, and that's one of the reasons, especially if you're within, you know, if you're not coming from far away, becoming a member is a great idea and planning to come back a few times because that's really the best way to see it. And I should say for people coming to visit Philadelphia, you mentioned the Barnes Foundation, which, of course, just reopened on the Parkway and is absolutely spectacular. But this is a great time to be visiting Philadelphia. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls are at the Franklin Institute. There's a Bruce Springsteen exhibition at the National Constitution Center, if that's your thing. The Philadelphia Museum of Art has a great exhibition called Visions of Arcadia. So, and honestly, it's just an incredible summer here in Philadelphia. So people who can come to visit and spend a decent amount of time can really stay very busy for a very long time. We've got cultural treasures here to be mined.
That's for sure. Thank you again so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, have a great day, too.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, yes. Definitely have to visit the place. And when you're in Philadelphia, when you come to Philadelphia, the best place to stay is, go ahead.
The Loews Philadelphia Hotel.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Okay. I'll tell you that I could have really gone for another half an hour talking about the museum.
I could hear that. It sounded great.
But for me, I would have had her talk so I can have everything so described so well that I don't have to go back. But I'm going to have to go back because, as I said, it's like I barely saw anything. You know, it's like the Barnes Foundation. But the Barnes Foundation, the difference between the two of them is the Barnes Foundation, I think you need a GPS.
Right. Yeah,
but
I
anyway.
Hear you. And I agree with her totally, my friend from the National Museum of Jewish History. This is a great summer to come to Philly. There's lots to do, and we're really happy that the Loews is right in the middle of the city. Yeah, you don't need to bring your car. You can park it and walk to any of these great exhibits and attractions.
Well, it's not just if you can walk, it's walkable.
Right.
Yeah, but one of the great things about it is, and I didn't realize until I was doing stuff, you got the trolley that stops nearby.
Correct. That's the Philadelphia.
Tour.
The Philadelphia Flash.
And the Flash.
Yeah. Is that the one you were talking about?
No, I was doing, what happened was that because I got a VIP pass, so I was doing the trolley works or one of the trolley things there.
Right.
With those tours, you know, I'd be on and off, you know, get on, get off and whatever. And it certainly was like, oh, I didn't have to walk very far to get one, you know, near the hotel. But what had happened is when I was at the Barnes Foundation, I was looking for the trolley, and I had to go all the way on the other side, and I see this trolley, and I'm thinking it's the trolley works, and it's a Flash. I'm going, what is this? And I went, okay. I mean, I heard, you know, you pay $2 every time you go on, and, you know, it takes you wherever. I didn't realize it, you know, for the $2, it took me right to the hotel.
Yeah, it's great. We have it every summer here in Philadelphia. There's a stop right outside the Lowe's Philly, and it's $2. Actually, you can hop on and off all day for that $2. And it's sponsored by the GPTMC and the Visitor Center here. And it's just a great way. Of course, the trolley works. Trolleys with the different stops are fabulous, too. But this is a great way just to get off your feet in between all these things you're doing in Philly.
Yeah, and to get around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, let's get to the hotel. Tell me about the hotel itself. It's not brand new, is it?
No, the hotel is not brand new. The building itself was built, was completed in 1932. It's a historic landmark. It's known as the PSFS building in Philadelphia. That stands for the Philadelphia Savings Fund Society. And it was, this is, of course, the city of firsts, and this is a corner of firsts. This was the first modern skyscraper. It's actually the second building and also the largest in the world to be constructed with central air conditioning. It's a fun fact here. They marketed it as manufactured weather. This is what modern ingenuity offers you in Philadelphia's ultra-modern office building. Year-round comfort, silence, cleanliness, healthfulness, increased efficiency, and no dust or noise from the city streets. A fun fact about the building is that for 1 week, an engineer lived inside the building, even sleeping here, in order to prove that air conditioning was not harmful. Lots of fun facts around in the beautiful building. It was built for $8 million. The PSFS was the working man's bank. They built it in the depression for $8 million, which would be unheard of today. They imported marble from 32 countries and Art Deco furnishings throughout. So it's a fabulous old building. We converted it into a hotel in 2000. And we worked with the Historical Society. It is a national landmark, so much of the original foundation is still here. Things like woods, floorings, the furniture, a lot of the Art Deco furniture was recovered. It was housed in the Art Museum after the building had closed in the mid-80s. And the new furnishings and design were all reflective of the Art Deco style of the building.
How many floors is it, by the way?
We have 33 floors to the hotel. The top three floors are our concierge club lounge, which has a nice library to relax in. We serve breakfast, continental breakfast on weekdays. We have meeting space on many of the bottom floors, so the guest room floors start at 6. So lots of great views. When the building was constructed, it was specifically constructed as the bank with lots of window space. So lots of windows in all the rooms, big, bold views of the city.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure.
Right.
By the way, is it the Continental Breakfast? I think it was there on the weekend, too.
We are just changing that to do weekends differently, just because, you know, here in Philly, weekdays, in Philly, we're really a business hotel on weekdays, and then weekends, it's really leisure, coming to see the attractions. This city is basically sold out every Saturday night. So on weekends, it's a totally different demographics in the city and in the hotel. So we just switched out the breakfast there just because of the sheer demand. We can't feed that many people up there. And Lowe's Hotels, yeah, at Lowe's Hotels, we're pet friendly, we're kid friendly. We have lots of different programs going on here. So on the weekends, we're full to the rafters with kids, pets, parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, reunions. So we've kind of just changed that out.
Yeah, because I notice when I go to hotels that do have, you know, the concierge level, that it's like not on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I was like surprised that, oh, okay, it's still, you know, you can still, you know, pop up there if you're taking those type of rooms.
Right. Yes, absolutely. On weekends, you can relax up there. There's TVs. There's great views of the city. There's a library area. We have some games and things like that, where instead of just sitting in your room.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's not enough to see, but
correct.
Outside.
Absolutely. And the hotel is in a fabulous location. We're right in the middle of the city, a block away from City Hall, which is another great attraction if you're coming. They do City Hall tours here on weekdays. And it's the largest city hall in the U.S., and it's very historic itself.
Mm. So now you also have a restaurant, you have a spa, right?
Right, Soul Food Restaurant. That is our signature restaurant. We have great chefs in this hotel, all of them local, South Philly, who love seafood. So we are a seafood-inspired restaurant. We serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Lowe's has a great breakfast at Lowe's menu featuring all kinds of fun things from smoothies to pancakes to local things like Philly cheesesteak and eggs, of course, and your regular breakfast alternatives. Lunch and dinner, as I said, our menus are seafood-inspired, but we have lots of great salads and appetizers and main courses.
Oh, cool. Were you able to get a hold of Mac, by the way?
I was, and I do believe he's going to dial in.
Okay, good.
So I won't
get into the menu. And then the spa, but the spa isn't really, it's separate, right?
The spa is not operated by the hotel. It's operated by a good friend of ours who has a couple of other spas in the city. It's a great space. I believe it's one of the biggest health club and spas in the city. State-of-the-art equipment. We've got a 20-meter lap pool up there surrounded by glass with a great view of the city. And then the spa also has spa and beauty services available for guests and people in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I had a facial done there.
Oh, great.
Yeah, they do a nice job.
Mm-hmm. They do a really nice job up there. And it's also good for to get a massage and things like that. And they they do beauty services off-site, so they have a location close by if you want to get hair done, and hair and nails and things like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, and in terms of, like, what's the difference in, like, you know, curious, like, when you're going, when you're purchasing a room at a hotel, what's the difference when, in terms of, it's not just the view, there's other things involved. What will make the difference in price?
Are you talking, Merle, between different hotels?
No, I mean, as an example, at Lowe's, what would make the difference price-wise?
The difference price-wise at Lowe's would be location of the room. So one is the view. Two would be the services in terms of whether you're up on the concierge club getting a breakfast on weekdays. On weekends, although we don't have breakfast in the club floor anymore, you do get a food and beverage credit if you buy that floor. So you can actually, on weekends, it's not just about having breakfast. You could use that credit if you wanted to come in for an afternoon drink or lunch or dinner or anything like that in the restaurant itself. So the pricing here in this hotel is really views and services on the club floor.
Okay.
And then size of rooms. We have, because this was not built as a hotel, we have some spectacular corner rooms that are larger than the regular standard rooms.
That's where I was, in a corner room, correct?
I believe so,
yes.
With windows,
yes,
on two sides.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, well, and I have, I haven't put up the photos yet on my blog, photos that I took from my windows.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's what everybody does up there, right?
Yep. So, and just as an idea, so what would be, like, so people get an idea what the price range of staying, well, I'm not looking business-wise. Someone's coming up, you know, going out to Philly and staying overnight.
Yeah, I mean, if you're coming on a weekend, that's a bit different than a weekday, but you're probably looking at from anywhere from $179 and upwards, depending on the level of business in the city at the time.
At your hotel, and I don't know if it tends to be like with a lot of hotels, so there's always a price difference between during the week and on the weekends, and it's actually, there's almost an expectation of thinking because it's a weekend that it should be more. Is that in that case, or is it the opposite case?
In a lot of cities like Philadelphia, it's actually less on weekends because we're such a high business weekday city. But it really varies by city and by season.
So, in other words, would you think people should take advantage of, when they come out to Philadelphia, of coming out for a weekend and staying there?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the city does a great job marketing itself, and with everything to do here in Philadelphia, anybody from the tri-states area or in the Northeast that drives in for one weekend and comes in like you did for a weekend, they can always come back, and that's kind of how we look at ourselves here in the market itself and at the hotel, because there is so much to do. Once you get here once and see how much there is to do, you can't wait to come back. And if you're in driving distance, it's an easy 2 or 3 hour drive, settle in, park the car, and you do your thing for 2 days.
Well, one of the things I came by Amtrak, and I must say it was a nice ride. It was very comfortable.
Absolutely.
And for some reason, I guess looking at a map, I'm thinking, oh, I really am far from the hotel. And when I took the taxi ride, I went, oh, it's not that far at all.
No, I think the city is like river to river. The city proper is 2 miles, and it's really a walkable city. And like you said, if you want to come in from the Amtrak, you can take a taxi from the 30th Street station. It's probably 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And City Hall is the closest, is City Hall the closest attraction to the hotel?
There's the City Hall. There is Macy's, of course, is an attraction because it was the old Wanamaker building with the organ in there and the eagle. We have Reading Terminal Market right across the street from the hotel, and that's where the market's open 7 days a week.
Oh, I forgot to go in there. Right.
Right. That's what you have to do next time. Go to Herschel's.
Right.
See?
I have to.
Right.
Well, I was trying to, the first thing I hit when I was there was I wanted to do the Italian market, to go in that area, to write about the whole Italian market area. And I went, okay, and that takes care of that. I was also there because of the Q Fest, which was a film festival that was there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was how much I could get in for the time that I was there. And I didn't think, it's funny because like I had been to the Reading terminal, is it Reading terminal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I had been there before, but it's like I really didn't think where I was. Because I think when I was staying, one time I was staying in, I guess at the square. What's that square?
Rittenhouse Square?
Yes. I was staying there at a hotel. By the way, I don't know how long you've been in Philly or working at the hotel, but do you remember that there was the only eco-friendly hotel in the whole United States there?
No. I didn't know that.
It was, they had taken the hotel. I mean, everything was like recycled.
Mm-hmm.
Like what they made, the floors and stuff like that. Things were recycled. There, no chemicals were used at the hotel. They weren't allowed to use chemicals. It was an entire thing of totally eco, no smoking in any part of the hotel. And this was like at least like about like 10 years ago when you know, to say no smoking and anywhere in a hotel. But
wow.
What was interesting, I thought the place would survive, and it's like, what? They went out of business? You know?
Clearly.
And at the time, like I was looking, when I did this, I was looking price-wise to see, I had an expectation that it would be more expensive than the other hotels.
Right.
But it wasn't. And I'm thinking, I didn't understand. I mean, for people who, and it's not that, you know, I mean, now, you know, most of the hotels you can't smoke or things like that. But for those people at the time that, you know, wanted all that, I couldn't imagine, you know, and the location-wise, that it would go out of business. But anyhow, so that's where I had stayed. So the distance between Rittenhouse and where you are is, it's walkable, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's walkable, but it's, you know, for me, at the time, from between there and where Reading Terminal was a distance. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's all relative, right? It's
yeah.
About 13 blocks, city blocks, which it depends on whether you like to walk or not. That's how far away Rittenhouse is. The old city and the historic district is just 5 blocks the other direction from the hotel. That goes right over to the Jewish Museum, the Constitution Center, Independence Hall, Liberty Bell.
So you're on Market.
We're on Market Street, exactly.
So you're Market in like 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking at the areas like Market in maybe 7th. That where all the historic stuff is, right?
Yeah, Market and 6 is where it actually starts.
6, okay.
And it only goes to 5th, so it's all there, and it's the most visited square mile in America, and everything historic is right there. You know, you can walk around to Ben Franklin's grave. I met some people in the lobby this morning that were going to do that, and Betsy Ross's house and Elfrith Alley, all of that. It's kind of like Rittenhouse. Once you get to that area, you know, you can do the historic district in a day if you exclude the museums, right? Go do some storytelling at Historic Philadelphia. They have character actors for part of the summer out there. I don't know if you saw any of that when you were here, but it's great fun.
How about now, what is it like in the fall? Those things, can you still, you know, get what, everything by coming during the fall?
Absolutely. The fall and spring are a great time here. You know, it's hot down here in the summer. Fall and spring, there's a lot going on. A lot of the theater and orchestra stuff happens there. We have things like Terror Behind the Walls at the Eastern State Penitentiary. This year we have a new exhibit, Open Air on the Parkway, which is for about 20 days. It's a GPS light exhibit on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Lots of restaurants, and the weather is great here. I'm from Toronto. I'm used to it getting cold and being really like fall, but the weather is really great here all the way till middle of November. So, again, if you come in the spring or the fall, the weather's great, the museums are great. You can come a couple of times and designate one as a foodie experience and one as a museum experience. And one is an outdoor experience.
Cool. That's so good. Yeah, because I have to come back.
Yes, you do.
There's too many things I haven't seen.
Right.
You know, it's like when I went the couple of times I've gone, it's like, okay, I've seen it all. You know, and it's like, and then I came back and I went, no, there's a lot of places I need to go back to again. I keep forgetting, you know, like a museum will change.
Correct.
Over a period of time, you know.
Right, and when you have 7 of them on one street, you could probably just make a living visiting them, right?
Oh yeah. That's the great thing about the flash or the one of those on and off kind of things. But by the way, unless I got this incorrect. What I was reading was that with the flash, every time you get on, it's $2. But if you pay $10, it's like then you can get on and off.
Yeah, I think there's some sort of a day pass. I'm not sure it's 10. I think it might be 5, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
There is a day pass.
Which is probably, and I'm not ignoring the, you know, like the trolley works or the bus tours or things like that. But the thing with the flash is you're not going to get, no one's going to give you a narrative.
Correct.
And it only runs during the summer, correct? The flash?
Yes.
Okay, so it's, as opposed to the on and off thing, other things. But also, because I didn't catch this there. I know there's the, I don't know what you call it, the underground. It's a subway, isn't it?
There is a subway system. We also have trolleys and we have a bus system. So the transit is very reasonable here. If you buy tokens, they're $1.50 each. That's how people get from, of course, the Lowe's Philadelphia to the sports complex, which is in South Philadelphia. You know, we're a sports-crazy city here. And so anybody going to see football, baseball, or hockey, they hop on the subway right at City Hall and take it right to the sports stadiums. They're all in the same place down there. The buses, same thing. You could catch a bus along Market Street that could take you to the west side of the city where you could walk to the art museum. So the regular transit here is quite good.
Oh, okay. Because I didn't catch whether there was, you know, other than the flash, whether there was, or the subway, whether there was another way of getting around that was like public transportation. So you said there's also the bus system.
Correct.
Okay. So, and I guess like it can, and I suppose like, you know, you can go on the internet and see what the map looks like to know where you're going. I know, for instance, like when I was going to like with the Italian market is, I'm looking and going, gee, I really wouldn't know how to get there other than by taxi.
Right.
And it didn't look like there was a subway nearby. So am I guessing that I could, that I would have been able to take a bus?
You absolutely would have been able to take a bus. I work with a fellow who takes a bus here to there every day.
Ah, okay. Now I got to know for the next time. I got to go back there to have gelato or something.
Exactly.
Well, like the gelato place is about 2 blocks away from you, from the hotel.
Yeah, Capogiro.
Yes. Are you into gelato?
Oh yeah, that's a great lunch treat in the hot, hazy summer days.
Oh man.
And that's a great little neighborhood where it is too, Midtown Village. That's one of our great friends around there. That's really become a nice little street. Great shops, great restaurants. And it's right around the corner from the hotel.
Now, let me ask you, what is the, because they have the area they call Center City. Now, what is that, what does it actually constitute?
Center City is I would classify Center City, it's the district that maintains and organizes things. And my understanding is it goes river to river, so the Delaware River to the Schuylkill, which is about that 2 miles. And from the convention center down to about the Italian market. They manage the activities in the city. They manage events going on. They have ambassadors out on the street. So there are these people in green and blue uniforms doing different things, and they're available to people visiting Philadelphia to give them directions or whatever they need, help in finding things.
Oh, I got the impression that Center City was just a particular area of Philadelphia to distinguish the area.
Yeah, that's what we call Center City is that area, but there are different neighborhoods That Center City district covers that. Center City is basically that. That's the center of the city. Because beyond the Schuylkill River, where the Amtrak train station is University City, which is where the universities are. But that's another part of the city. That's another neighborhood.
Right. Oh, yeah, I remember staying one night out there at a B&B.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
That's where the universities and hospitals, most of the hospitals are.
Yeah.
We have Jefferson down here, but that's that side of it.
Yeah. I'm getting all these little flashbacks of where I stayed.
Exactly.
I did one. I came out there to do a wine tasting press trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, sure, I could handle that, because I'm thinking wine tasting, you take the wine, you sniff it, blah, blah, put a little in your mouth, swish it around, and spit it out. That's how you taste wine.
Right.
Wrong.
Uh-oh.
We were at one restaurant. There were actually 12 glasses of wine for us to be tasting.
Oh.
I'm going, we only went to one place, and I don't remember where it was, where it was an actual winery. And I'm looking and I'm going, I can't believe that the writers are still drinking. And I'm the only one that's doing this spitting out.
Good for you.
I'm going, how could they do this? But I guess, well, whatever. Anyway, but that's one of the times that I was there. Coming from New York City, I think the only thing, if you want to say, that I would kind of miss is the amount of theater, maybe. That's probably, you know, other than that, there's certainly enough, you know, attractions and things to see.
Yeah, and Philadelphia is known for its great restaurants, too. We got some of the best chefs in the country opening lots and lots of restaurants here. So I would agree with you. The amount of theater, we do have a theater district here. It just doesn't have the amount that you have in New York.
Yeah. And when Mac, if we get Mac to call in on time.
I guess that's not going to happen. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, but I'm gonna let you go.
Okay, Meryl. It was lovely talking to you. Come back to the Lowe's anytime.
Okay. Well, I probably will. I think I'm writing myself a little note for an article, Philly in Fall.
Great idea.
You know, so I'll be chatting with you before I come back out there, because, as I said, there's too many things that I've missed. So.
All righty. Well, you
have
a wonderful day.
You too.
Nice talking to you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Yes. I love the hotel. I don't know what this calling in thing is about, but let's see what I have. Oh, wait a minute. Wait. First, let's do a sponsor. Let's get a sponsor. Sponsor. One of my favorite airlines.
Thank you for calling JetBlue. May I help you?
My cousin was telling me you guys have extra legroom.
Uh-huh. We have extra legroom as compared to a normal coach seat.
Okay. If I don't have an extra leg, can I use that room for something else?
No, that is not what the extra leg implies. We took out one whole row of seats, and that gave the rest of those rows a couple of extra inches of leg room.
Ah.
I understand what you mean. The words extra leg imply that, but it has nothing to do with having an extra leg.
I'm a pretty literal person.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be taking it very literally.
I guess a little too literally.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help you with?
I think that's it. You've been pretty helpful.
Thanks for calling JetBlue.
Dear traveler, Stretch out. We now have the most legroom in coach. Visit us at JetBlue.com. Sincerely, JetBlue. Based on average fleet-wide seat pitch of U.S. Airlines.
Oh, yes. Where am I JetBluing next? Oh, I think I'm going to be, hopefully, I'm going to be JetBluing. Well, actually, I think I'll be JetBluing to Boston because I'm going to be going to Provincetown. What JetBlue is paired with Cape Air. So I'm not sure whether there's a lot of so many ways to get from New York to Provincetown, including I could take JetBlue and then take the ferry boat, which is a lot less expensive than Cape Air. But, of course, you're then getting to the ferry, and it takes longer than going by Cape Air. But anyway, let's start. It's 17.
I learned the truth at 17. That
Mac, where are
was
you?
Meant for beauty queens. In high school, girls with clear skin smiles who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew. The Friday night charades of you were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say come dance with me. It isn't all it seems. It's 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I ugly duckling girls like me. We all play the game when we dare to cheat ourselves at solitaire, inventing lovers on the phone, repenting of the lies unknown. They call and say, commence with me, murmur vague obscenity. Ugly girls like me at 17.
Yes. Do we all remember when we were 17? Oh, yes. How could I forget? That's when I was in the movie Up the Down Staircase. Claim to fame. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to throw in one more song, and if Mac doesn't call in, I will just end the show early. And let's get from... I should probably have... I'm looking at the songs that I have, and I realize they're really kind of... old songs, but okay. It's one of my favorites. And up to
we starve, look at one another short of breath.
The beat is up.
Walking proudly in our winter coats, wearing smells from laboratories, facing a dying nation of moon.
I say? Let the sun shine. Instead of all these cloudy days here. Okay, well, Mac needs to get his cheese together. Okay. Well, I'm just going to, like, end the show early and relax a bit. I'm going to this Italian-style sports bar this evening to partake in the food and watch the Olympics. So have a great day, afternoon, evening, whatever you do, and visit Philadelphia. Go ahead. I just clicked. Let's do it again. Click out.